Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you were casting a movie, say an old-time Western, and your actors were Mick Jagger and Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones, no, I don't know why they're your actors, just go with me on this one, which would you cast as the sheriff, the good guy in the white hat, and which would play the villain in the black hat? Now remember, Keith has spent much of his career kind of playing up his whole dissolute bad boy image. But the answer to our casting question might not be so straightforward. Chuck Klosterman will talk about his recent book, I Wear the Black Hat, grappling with villains, real and imagined. In addition to some seriously bad dudes, he writes a lot about musicians, including Mick and Keith. Even the Eagles don't emerge unscathed. He'll join us later. And the band Haim consists of three sisters from L.A. who've become a pop phenomenon in just the past few months. We'll hear why when they play live in our studio. But first, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Steve Reich has had a huge influence on the sound of contemporary classical music, but the worlds of electronic music and rock have also taken note, and in recent years, that influence has gone both ways. This piece by Reich is called 2x5, and it's basically a classical work for two rock quintets. Now the Met Museum will be the site of a concert that'll feature the New York premiere of an even newer work called Radio Rewrite, inspired by the music of the band Radiohead. Steve Reich joins us on Soundcheck. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, John.
So 2x5 was inspired by the sound of like rock instrumentation in general.
Right, exactly. Particularly the electric bass, yeah.
This piece inspired by the sound of a specific rock band.
Yeah, well, what happened was I was invited to go to Poland, Sacrum Profanum Festival, which the basic idea of the festival is new music, new rock, house, electronic music. And they invited Johnny Greenwood. From Radiohead. And Johnny Greenwood came and was going to play Electric Counterpoint, the piece I wrote for Pat Metheny, but instead of dragging out the old Metheny tracks, he made his own backing tracks, which is a big deal. It takes a lot of work.
There were, what, 12, 13 backing tracks?
Yeah, about 11 backing tracks, and he did them all, including two electric bass tracks. So I thought, well, this guy's taking it seriously. And I knew that he had been at Oxford, had studied viola, that he read, that he composed. I heard his music for There Will Be Blood, and if when you hear that, you think, guy likes Messiaen. You'd never think he was a rocker. Anyway, we met. He played the piece beautifully. We really hit it off. And when I came home, I thought, I know this guy. I know everything about this band. I never heard a note of the music. I got to get a little education. So I went to their site, and I just listened and looked at some of the very, very nice videos. Two tunes jumped out at me, and one of them is very well known, Everything in Its Right Place. Another one is known also, Jigsaw Falling Into Place from the Rainbows album. And I had been working on something else which was going absolutely nowhere, and I thought, overboard, trash it. I'd like to grab some material, some melodic, some harmonic from these two tunes. I just really decided, well, look, I'm not going to write variations on their piece. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm not going to score it for rock musicians. It's scored for one flute, one clarinet, string quartet, two vibes, two pianos, and one electric bass, because electric bass. I love electric bass. So that's it. And after giving them half my royalties, it's all done.
All right, let's hear a little bit from one of the songs that inspired Steve Reich's Radio Rewrite. This is the original Radiohead version of Jigsaw Falling Into Place.
Thank you.
Just a bit of Jigsaw falling into place from Radiohead's album In Rainbows. You mentioned the electric bass, and there's a very strong presence of the electric bass immediately as soon as it comes in. The chord progression is an unusual one, too.
They're not doing doo-wop, that's for sure. And I added a couple of chords. When I took the progression, put it into two sharps, and because that would put the two tunes in the same key so I could go back and forth. Mm-hmm. Decided, yeah, I'll take this harmony, but I'm going to take some liberties with it. And if you play the opening, you'll see that, yes, it's the same, but no, it isn't.
All right. Let's do that. Let's hear a little bit of Steve Reich's piece called Radio Rewrite, played by the group Alarm Will Sound. Steve Reich's piece Radio Rewrite, based on two songs by the band Radiohead. The work's getting its New York premiere at the Met Museum, on Saturday, November 16th. That band, Alarm Will Sound, performing an all-Steve Reich program. And Steve, people who are familiar with your music, there are some of the signposts, the interlocking keyboards, whether that's vibraphones or piano, the strings that tend to kind of hold the long, sustained tones over it. So very much your piece. Now, you mentioned that Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead, you guys met because he was playing your electric counterpoint, which you originally wrote for Pat Metheny, a jazz guitarist. And the work has a kind of jazz swing to it, especially at the end. Have you been surprised by how many rock guitarists have been drawn to this piece?
Well, this is probably, along with New York Counterpoint, the most performed piece I ever wrote. And one of the most popular for people to listen to, and one of the most popular for people to remix. So it's had a very robust life.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. The piece actually was written, you know, sort of Pat Metheny was in my head, and I think that's a good way to write with people in mind. But the fact of the matter is, if you write for a good musician, you know, there are other good musicians in this world, and they will say, you know, that's nice. Now let's just try it a little bit my way.
Yeah.
And they do. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I mean, the electric guitar is the instrument that comes from rock and roll. And Metheny, even at the get-go, was always kind of like, yeah, he's a jazz player, but, you know, there's that rock instrumentation, and he is a basic electric guitar player. So there was always that ambiguity, which, you know, he was totally at home with. He was the generation beginning to do that spontaneously. Mm-hmm. That has just continued. You know, the idea of people being trained as violists and taking up the guitar, or Mark Stewart being a cellist and then becoming Paul Simon's music director as well as the resident electric guitarist in Bang on a Can. So we're seeing a new generation of music, which Bryce Dessner is another example. You know, comes out of Yale, can read anything you put in front of him, who's on 2x5, and, you know, is one of the leaders along with his brother of the National. So this is now, the mark of our time.
Yeah. Now, Bryce was here just a couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
And, in fact, he had something to say about your piece, Electric Counterpoint.
In my case, you know, I always say, well, Steve Reich has been a big influence, and even specifically on my guitar playing. So I think a piece like Electric Counterpoint, which I would have heard, you know, as a teenager, is as influential for me in terms of how I play guitar in the National, for instance, as, you know,
Hendrix.
Yeah, or, you know, so that's an example of just the way that people, you know, with different backgrounds end up in the musical world.
That's Bryce Dessner of The National talking about my guest Steve Reich and his piece Electric Counterpoint. That's actually the Pat Metheny version we heard a little bit
yes,
of,
right.
Although Bryce has performed this piece
yes,
as
I hear
well.
Yes, I think he threatens to record it too.
Now, this isn't such a new thing, Steve, because rockers like Brian Eno and David Bowie and Kraftwerk, these guys were onto your music back in the 70s.
Well, do you know that the latest David Bowie hit, the remix, Hello Steve Reich remix, is based
by
on
James
Clabby.
Murphy.
By James Murphy. Is based on Clabby.
Yes, yeah.
And it's going to be on David Bowie's latest deluxe release. So, I mean, yeah, David Bowie was in the audience in Berlin at the National Gallery in 1976 when we did the German premiere of Music for 18. And Brian Eno, I was playing a concert in London with my ensemble in 1974 at the Queen Elizabeth Hall, South Bank. Guy comes up afterwards, long hair, lipstick, says, "How do you do? I'm Brian Eno."
Good for you.
Later, I thought poetic justice. I was the kid at Birdland sitting, you know, in the kids section listening to Miles Davis and Charlie Parker and Kenny Clarke, and there's Brian Eno listening to me. That's the way life's supposed to be. And Brian's been very forthcoming. I mean, he said basically he felt his career began when he heard It's Gonna Rain. So I feel, you know, very proud of that.
Yeah. Now, so with all these, you know, rock musicians sort of putting your name out there as a formative influence in their music, were you listening, what were you listening to back then? In the 70s.
John Coltrane.
So you really didn't know who Brian Eno was. You must have known who Bowie was.
I know who both of them were. I knew there was a big band called Radiohead, and they were considered very progressive, and they did all kinds of wonderful things, and I wondered what they were. When I heard of Brian Eno, it was Roxy Music time, and I really didn't hear it. I think what happened with Brian Eno is my son sort of snuck a CD into my car of the opening of Place with No Name. It's got that incredible psychedelic long-held chord.
Oh,
at the very beginning from the Joshua Tree album.
The U2 song, Streets
U2,
of
No Name. Yeah, but that's arranged by Brian Eno.
Right.
It's Eno's arrangement. I put a thing on, I said, "Am I on acid? What is this?" You know, I didn't know. This is not my music. And then, you know, in comes Bono. And I find, oh, Ezra put the U2 album in. So, I mean, it's a two-way street. I mean, it's always been a two-way street in Western music, John, except for when I went to music school.
Right.
When my generation helped open the window that had always been open until, I would have to say, time of Schoenberg, Berg, and Weber, and particularly Arnold Schoenberg. And that meant no harmony, no pulsing rhythm of any sort, no melody that any postman is ever going to whistle.
Right.
And if you did otherwise, you were laughed at.
Now, so this piece that you've written, Radio Rewrite, again, it's getting its New York premiere on Saturday, November 16th, at the Met Museum. The band Alarm Will Sound, doing an all-Steve Reich program. It's in five parts.
Right.
And fast, slow, fast, slow, fast. So
you got it.
The fast parts are all kind of based on the song we heard earlier, right?
Yes, they're all based on Jigsaw Falling Into Place, and the two slow movements come from Everything in Its Right Place, which is a kind of slow, brooding, you know, very mysterious song.
As we can hear in the original. Radiohead with Everything in Its Right Place, originally from the album Kid A, and one of the two songs that... Are you humming the song?
I'm singing Everything is 1-5-1, and 1-5-1 is everything.
Yeah.
In Western music. I mean, I'm sure that Tom York or whoever was principally involved in that wasn't thinking about that at all. But when I heard that, I thought to myself, that's perfect. You know, he's setting the basis of Western music casually as everything, and that appears in my piece. That I could not resist but to deal with that, because it's beautiful, it's fundamental to It's the common bridge between, you know, Haydn to Radiohead, and it's found all over the world too.
Yeah.
The fifth is the magic interval.
And so that's what's underpinning the second movement of Radio Rewrite.
The second and fourth movements are taken from everything in its right place. Yeah.
This is from Steve Reich's work, Radio Rewrite, and the band Alarm Will Sound. That is Steve Reich's piece, Radio Rewrite, so titled because it is based on two songs by the band Radiohead. The group Alarm Will Sound is giving that piece its New York premiere at the Met Museum on Saturday, November 16th. While we were listening to that, Steve, I asked you, is there a voice in there somewhere? I mean,
as I was telling you, I was at the premiere, and I was sitting in the back near the audio desk, as usual, and Colin Greenwood, Johnny Greenwood's brother, who plays in the band as well, came over. He knew who I was. He came over and said, listen, this is great. I really love it. He says, and when I heard it, he says, I could hear the words. And I took that as a great compliment because basically, you know, when you set words to music, they should just be glued together. And so when you hear one, you just hear the other. And but I mean, it's one thing for me to say, it's another thing for him to say. I'm really just glad to hear it. So I'm very pleased I could see you're hearing it too.
So based on the song Everything in Its Right Place by Radiohead, have you heard from the rest of the band? What do they think of this?
I haven't heard a peep, and I guess they're probably waiting for the recordings because I think they're pretty, you know, sensitive musicians, and I think they realize that what they've heard, especially in the BBC, not well done, but it doesn't have, let's say, the characteristic rhythmic vitality that people are used to in my music. Mm-hmm. So that will be forthcoming at the concert on the 16th of November, and it will certainly be on the recording, which will come out, I think, in the middle of 2014.
All right. Well, Steve, it's always great to catch up with you, and, you know, I know this is not the first time you've based music on someone else's. There's the Stephen Sondheim Finishing the Hat.
Right. There's Proverb from Perrotin.
From all those centuries ago. But I've really enjoyed what I've heard of Radio Rewrite. Looking forward to hearing more. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Steve Reich, my guest on Soundcheck. Mm-hmm. 2013's been a big year for the trio of sisters in the Los Angeles-based Haim. They released an acclaimed debut, played the Glastonbury Festival in the UK, and they're set to play Saturday Night Live later this month. Hear Haim performing in the Soundcheck studio next. And later, Chuck Klosterman talks about music and villains. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and if you'd like to see some truly hideous man crying, I suggest you watch the video for this song called The Wire. It features the three sisters who make up the LA rock band Haim and an array of men who just can't hold back the tears after the girls break their hearts. And really, who can blame them for being upset? Because Esti, Danielle, and Alana Haim are seriously on the rise. The group topped the BBC Sound of 2013 poll, and this is Haim playing live with a song called Honey and I.
Good night. I know there's nothing good in goodbye. But she laid me to no other line, no other line. Eyes wild. When you walk through the door, you made your way across the floor. All little girls that are try their turns. And no, see, I'm not afraid no more.
I'm not afraid no
to turn you away no more.
To turn you away no
to turn you away. To turn you away. Cause my honey, my honey, you know.
That's called Honey and I, live performance by Haim here in the Soundcheck studio. Haim is not just the name of the band, it is the last name of the three sisters who are at the heart of the band. Esty on bass, although there, Esty playing percussion mostly, doing some vocals. Danielle singing and playing guitar.
Yep.
And Alana, also a guitarist and keyboardist, but still more percussion on that song.
Playing everything else.
Playing everything else. Which doesn't leave Dash behind our drums with a whole lot to do, but he was banging away on some stuff
on
there
some bongos
as well. So, you know, one of the things, I guess, when you're starting a band is you got to figure out what to call yourselves. Haim, you know, people, you must be getting all kinds of crazy pronunciations in your name.
Yeah. I would say that's fair.
Yeah.
So do you guys have like a strategy for what you tell people, how to handle the name? H-A-I-M, by the way.
Yeah. I think the easiest way to remember it is it kind of sort of rhymes with time.
Yeah.
If time was, as you said, a diphthong.
Yeah.
As you Haim, described
Haim.
It.
Yeah. Recently on the show, I was sort of recalling my growing up in Queens with a heavy Queens accent where every vowel became a diphthong. And yes, we would have said time.
Right, time.
So, yeah.
What time is
it? What time?
Yeah.
So is it true, Danielle, that you guys started in a kind of like rock cover band with your parents?
Yes, it is true. We when we were younger... my dad plays drums kind of for fun, and my mom played guitar kind of for fun. And growing up, my mom would kind of teach us, you know, simple Beatles songs on guitar. And, mm-hmm. you know, she was a huge Joni Mitchell fan. She kind of simplified the Joni Mitchell chords for us.
I was going to say, that's not simple stuff
yeah,
at all.
Yeah, no, Joni is very complex, but, you know, she'd simplify just to kind of open chords. And then as we got older, it kind of got a little more, my dad kind of wanted to play, you know, Santana, and which I think involved more of a live band feel. And
yeah.
So we just kind of picked up electric guitars. Esty picked up a bass, and we started playing kind of rock and roll covers. Yeah.
So in addition to the Beatles and Joni Mitchell, who would you be playing?
I mean, so many.
So many. Tina Turner.
Tina Turner, Rolling Stones, Eagles.
Earth, Wind & Fire.
Yeah, Earth, Wind & Fire. Fire.
Mm-hmm.
We had like one Billy Joel cover.
Yeah.
Which one?
You may be right.
You may be right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's a good one. Kills it.
Great outro.
It brings down the house,
yeah.
if you will.
You'd be surprised.
Do you still do them?
I mean, we have one long-standing gig that we do every year at this church in the San Fernando Valley where we grew up. And it's kind of like a rock and roll church. It's like a school also. And every like 80s star's children go to this school. So they also join in the fun at the fundraiser.
Yeah.
So technically we've opened for Billy Idol because he did it 1 year. So technically we've opened for him.
And Toto.
And Toto.
Don't forget
did
Toto.
Did it 1 year. So technically we've opened for Toto. The Cow Sills, can't forget about.
Really?
Yeah.
They're still around?
Oh, yeah.
Still around.
Kicking. Alive.
Wow. You love. Are you a Cow Sills fan?
Well, I know who they are.
Flowers I mean, in her hair.
It's just a long time ago. That's
yeah,
like,
we love the Cow Sills.
Okay.
They're great. They're, you know, they bring down the house.
All right. And how did Mom and Dad feel when suddenly the family band didn't have them in it anymore?
I think they were just kind of like, all right, well, we're just going to, you know, keep doing our day job, and you
right.
guys can continue doing whatever
you want
to do.
They were always
very proud. You
know? Now, Esty, you went to UCLA,
yes,
right?
Yes, I did.
And your degree was in, was it?
Ethnomusicology.
Ethnomusicology.
Yeah. Do you know what that is?
I do.
Nice.
What particular, like, region or style?
Area?
Yeah.
My emphasis, I had two emphases. One was Bulgarian folk music.
Uh-huh.
So Bulgarian voice.
That kind
voice.
Of diaphonic singing.
Yeah. The really, really close seconds.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really hard. It was definitely like, it, you know, screwed with my mind a little bit, trying to get those harmonies right. And then the other one was Brazilian carnival music and uh-huh. also a little bit of candomblé.
Oh, okay. Which is the sort of the stuff you hear in Bahia.
Yeah.
The
Northern Brazil.
Stuff.
Yeah. The African diasporic music of
right.
Brazil.
The Bulgarian harmony thing, that, you know, I mean, you said it sort of played with your, you know,
yeah.
your mind's ear. When it comes time for the three of you to kind of work out these harmonies mm-hmm. and stuff, do you find yourself thinking, you know, let's just get that little second thing
yeah.
happening?
We, you know, we try. There
I
were
mean,
definitely
Kate
times.
Bush did it really well.
Yeah, Kate Bush did do it really yeah. well.
Well, Kate Bush actually hired Bulgarian
yeah,
singers.
She did.
Yeah,
she But she kind of, she fit it in her music so well where it didn't seem, at least to me, it seemed. It seemed like it kind of fit, and even though it was kind of this, you know, otherworldly sounding thing, it fit in her pop music, I think, really well.
Right.
But anyway.
All right, so you guys, you know and like Joni Mitchell, Kate Bush, the Cow Sills, the Beatles. I mean, your parents clearly did a good job of...
You should tell them. They're,
yeah,
they're in the room
they're
over there.
Okay,
they're
well,
with
they're,
us.
They're listening in. They just heard me say it. Let's put all that training back to work, shall we?
Right.
We're speaking with the band Haim. Their debut album, Days Are Gone, here in the Soundcheck studio. You want to do Falling next?
Yes.
Sure.
Once again, this is the band Haim, live on Soundcheck.
Oh, I give a little into the moment, like I'm standing at the edge. I know that no one's gonna turn me around. Just one more step, I can let go. Oh, and in the middle, I can hear the voices and the calling for me now. I know that nothing's gonna work me now. 'Cause I'm a slave to the sound. And they're calling, don't stop, I'll never give up, and I'll never look back. So my head up, and if it gets rough, it's time to get up.
They keep saying, don't stop, no one's ever enough. I'll never look back, never give up. And if it gets rough, it's time to give up. Oh. I'm trying not to make a sound, 'cause I'll be found out somehow. So keep calling me, don't stop, I'll never give up. And I'll never look back, just hold your head up. And if it gets rough, it's time to get up. You keep saying, don't stop, no one's never enough. I'll never look back, never give up. And if it gets rough, it's time to give up. Up and now I'm falling.
Is Haim live on Soundcheck with a version of their single called Falling. Esty, when you guys are writing, do you write together or is it a...
Yes.
Really?
It's a very, very collaborative process, which is actually really nice because it's, you know, we just kind of get together in our living room and kind of just talk about what's going on in our lives and then we just write some tunes.
That's it. So, you just write some
tunes. Write some tunes.
Make it sound so simple.
You know? But no, you know, for us, it's just kind of like it's kind of therapeutic, you know, just to kind of be able to talk freely with each other and.
But now, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, I have a bunch of sisters, I have a couple of daughters, and you know, sometimes they love each other, and sometimes they don't want to be anywhere near
each other.
Now, you guys, you're on the road. You're in close quarters over long stretches of time. How does that work?
It just does.
I think it's just, I mean, we've grown up together, and we know.
Well, that's kind of what sisters do.
Right, they grow up together.
You know?
Right, you know, you grow up, and, you know, I think for us, it was just kind of, you know, we know what buttons not to push.
Okay.
But we're also human at the same time, you know, like, you know, everyone has their bad days and But at the end of the day, we're sisters and we love each other. And not only that, but Dash also knows how to keep us in line.
Dash
is the referee. Dash keeps us on a very tight leash.
Days Are Gone is the name of the record, a much-anticipated debut from the band Haim. And it's been a lot of fun having the three of you here.
Thank you.
Of you. Dash, too.
Don't forget Dashiki over there.
Playing for us here in the studio. The band is called Haim. This is Soundcheck.
Keep your heart locked tight. Don't let your mind read that.
Music critic and author Chuck Klosterman has a new book called I Wear the Black Hat, about villains in pop culture. He'll tell us about some of the dastardly musicians found in the pages of his book. Chuck Klosterman, next on Soundcheck. By the way, WNYC has a brand new app, and it's a great way to listen to Soundcheck on the go. Download the new WNYC app from the iTunes Store. It's free. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Villains, both real and imaginary, are the subject of Chuck Klosterman's recent book, I Wear the Black Hat. Some of his villains are politicians. Some are criminals. Some are even musicians.
You can't hide.
Eagles? Villains? Well, they do appear in Chuck Klosterman's book, I Wear the Black Hat, though I'll have to let him explain why. Chuck writes the Ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine, amongst numerous other projects, and joins us here in the Soundcheck studio. Hey, Chuck.
Hey, good to be here.
So when thinking about villains, I mean real villains, musicians aren't the first group of people to come to mind, but they pop up constantly in your book.
Well, that's true. I mean, if my book was somehow more comprehensive, or if it was an attempt to actually prove who are the biggest villains in, say, the 20th century, obviously there would be almost no musicians, probably non-musicians in there. But I'm more dealing with just the idea sort of how we perceive to be the good or bad person in any equation, mm-hmm. regardless of the magnitude. And because, you know, I've been a rock critic for, I guess, almost 20 years now or whatever, it's like it's not, I guess, surprising that I often see this relationship in musicians. In fact, when I was writing the book, I had to make like a decision early on. I'm not going to talk about the Beatles and the Stones as an example for every time I'm right. trying to illustrate some point about the difference between, say, good and evil in sort of a metaphorical way.
But if you had done that, which is good and which is evil?
Well, I mean, the perception is that the Beatles are good and the Rolling Stones are the bad version of them. But then within the bands, you know, interestingly, Paul McCartney is generally seen as the villain of the Beatles. He's really the only Beatle that's polarizing. Almost every other Beatle has just sort of a general positive sense toward, you know. Yeah. In the Rolling Stones, over time, Mick Jagger has become sort of the villainous character, even though Keith Richards spent pretty much all of the 70s trying to be a villain on purpose. So it's interesting how that worked out, how time changes these things.
Yeah. One of the – an early example of this in the book is your own sort of change of heart about the Eagles. Now, of all the musicians you could put in a book about villains, I mean, the Eagles, they're like almost the definition of light, L-I-T-E, rock. How do they come into play here?
I mean, sonically, that's true. I think as cultural icons, though, they are the villains of classic rock, certainly. You know, I guess what I was thinking about was how, you know, there was a period in my life when I just sort of thought the Eagles are boring. You know, mm-hmm. I was into metal. The Eagles seemed both light and old to me, you know. But I didn't have a real stake in it. I just didn't think they were interesting. Then at one point when I started getting kind of intrigued by the idea of writing about music and sort of the import of rock criticism on music itself, my relationship with the Eagles changed. And then for a long period of time, I hated them the most. They were to me, they became some sort of symbol for what I was pretending, I guess, to be against. And then at one point, it all swung back. Sort of I had this moment when I just suddenly realized that you know, obviously the opposite of love is not hate. Mm-hmm. You know, the opposite of love is indifference. So the fact that I had this investment with the Eagles meant something, and I started thinking about why I would feel that way. I think a lot of people probably have this experience with maturation, when suddenly they realize that something that they viewed as an emotional reaction, they sort of realize, well, this was a sort of an intellectual process that I just pushed into a feeling, you know?
Yeah. So you no longer hate the Eagles.
No.
But they're still in the book.
Well, the Eagles are, because they're just the best example of this thing that I was talking about. Yeah, I mean, you know, I suppose now, you know, it's not just that I don't hate the Eagles, you know, I guess I like them.
Well, I'm running down the road trying to loosen my load. I got 7 women on. The sound of your own wheels drive you crazy. Lighten up while you still can. Don't even try to understand. Just find a place to make your stand. Take it easy.
The Eagles with Take It Easy. Actually, that song appears in Chuck Klosterman's book, I Wear the Black Hat, the whole bit about the 7 women, you know, 4 of them want to own me, 2 want to stone me, 1 says she's a friend. Very often in your book, the villains aren't just people who do wrong. It's often how they talk about it afterwards. It's, you know, sometimes what you say is even more important than what you do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially in a mediated culture that's almost irrefutable, that many actions, I think, if done in a vacuum, would be perceived by people as almost neutral. I mean, they might know, well, this is morally problematic, but I wonder what the motive was or what was the real story here. It's really only through the person's attempt to frame their own life that people sort of make these really galvanized decisions about, like, well, I'm against this person now. Mm. Or this person, to me, symbolizes what I like about this band. So therefore, as the band breaks up, I am going to side with them and also believe their side. You know, when you see bands break up, for example, Van Halen was a good example of this, you know. What happened was that you could really make a very good argument that both the David Lee Roth camp and the Van Halen camp made these sort of huge mistakes and were missing the big picture. But what ended up happening is people pretty much decided what part of Van Halen they liked the most, mm-hmm. what they thought was sort of the to them what made the band meaningful. And then they picked which side that was and then just believed their story. You know?
Chuck Klosterman is my guest on Soundcheck, author of books such as Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs and Fargo Rock City. And his latest is called I Wear the Black Hat. Chuck, you may know, also writes the Ethicist column for the Sunday New York Times Magazine. You spend some time pondering hip-hop, NWA and 2 Live Crew, you know, 2 of the kind of big headline bands of 20-odd years ago, and how, you know, in hip-hop, that was the moment where true villainy was possible to an extent that it's not today.
Well, I think villainy is still very possible today, but it was different during this window of time from about 1987 to 1993 when there was, almost intellectual and sophisticated interest in this idea of political correctness. Now, when people use the term politically correct now, it seems very antiquated.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a strange term to even be using, but during that period, it really was like an essential part of discourse if you were talking about ideas. And what I think is very interesting is that in general, when people say the culture is coarsening, I think that collectively we agree on that. That every 10 years, every generation, however you look at it, the culture gets a little coarser. And yet the exceptions to this, at least from like a linguistic standpoint, is hip-hop and stand-up comedy, where there was that period with 2 Live Crew and Andrew Dice Clay when the language they were using, I mean, it was literally nursery rhymes that were filled with profanity.
Right.
And it really was the apex of the ability to use language as a way to shock people. So, you know, that's sort of, you know, and 2 Live Crew has really now, I think when people look back on them as artists. It seems sort of charming and goofy. It doesn't really seem harmful, where with Energized Clay that has happened less. People have been less forgiving of that period. NWA I talk about just sort of as the idea of a group who consciously wanted to be perceived as villains and worked very hard to achieve that and kind of made that almost the backbone of their aesthetic. We are criminals.
Right. Yeah. So with the benefit of hindsight, Two Live Crew looks like some kind of pantomime villain, you know, not – they're just – they're kind of fun. They were there. They're an icon, you know,
yes,
sort of
not really a villain at all.
Yeah. Whereas NWA, are they still evil geniuses in a sense for an album like Straight Outta Compton?
I mean, it's easier to make the argument that in some contexts they were geniuses than they were evil. You know, I mean, now the sophisticated way to look back on those records is that, oh, it was kind of a cartoon, that it was that they were sort of amplifying what white America's perception of what Compton was like and saying, okay, we're going to embody this in totality and then you're going to actually buy this thing you're afraid of. And, you know, at the time, when you read interviews with Ice Cube or whoever, Eazy-E, the thing I think that was really shocking to anyone was the amount of apathy they seemed to express, the nihilistic view that like, you know, life is meaningless. It's inherently meaningless, particularly for us. So we're just going to sort of try to almost take as much as we can in the short amount of time that we probably have. And they used like a lot of scare words, you know, and also tried to work from the premise that what they were doing, regardless of what you thought of it, was just more real. That's often the best argument to make when there is no other argument, that this is just more real than other things, you know.
Well, let's hear a little bit from NWA, from that album, Straight Outta Compton. Obviously, the cleaned-up radio version of NWA's Straight Outta Compton from the classic album of the same name. We're speaking with Chuck Klosterman about his new book called I Wear the Black Hat. Of course, a title referring to the old cowboy movies. The bad guy wears the black hat. The good guy wears the white hat. NWA, I mean, the way they fit in, it seems, goes to something you said just before we heard that clip, which is the apathy about, you know, the state of life in Compton in 1987, 88. The thing you keep coming back to in talking about all kinds of villains from all walks of life is the ones who know the most and care the least. Is that what we're getting from NWA here?
To a degree, yes. I mean, they're a good example of that. Now, it's not, you know, it's always dangerous when you're writing an essay book or collection of essays to say like, well, okay, I'm gonna have this thesis and I'm going to ram it down your throat. It's not like I start with the premise that the villain is the person who knows the most and cares the least. And there are certainly key exceptions to this. But, I mean, it's not like I'm trying to prove this idea as much as through the process of writing about these very disparate characters in many different walks of life. I mean, you know, music, but also politics, sports, and also, of course, like fictional realms. The things that I kept seeing over and over again did lead me to this conclusion that what is really discomforting to people is this idea that they see someone who can almost effortlessly manipulate the world, who has an understanding of what people want. They're designed to be successful, and yet they have no investment with what that success means.
So the example of Kim.com, the large German guy who lives in New Zealand, lived in New Zealand,
yes,
with surrounded by, you know, giraffe sculptures yeah, and stuff, and who was arrested because he's the guy who created Mega Upload.
Yes. And you know, and when he was arrested, I will admit, I did not, I'd probably heard of him, but I didn't know much about him. At first, I think to myself, this is a great example of where they're trying to, like, to consciously villainize somebody because he kind of lives a ridiculous life and he lives in a different country and he's easy to sort of pin all downloading on. But then, to my utter surprise, 2 weeks after this happened, suddenly downloading went from being almost too easy to, like, too hard for the average person to do. I mean, I'm sure there's people listening to this who are like, well, I still rip music all the time. But for the average consumer, mm-hmm, it became very difficult. And what was what's fascinating about him is, you know, he has this real understanding of, I think, of how commerce is changing with technology and what people really want, and especially what's the expectation of the audience now. What do they think is worth paying for? What do they think should be free? And he's trying to sort of move this agenda forward, partially for his own benefit, also because I do think he thinks it's a better system, but he just does not care how that will impact everybody else in this kind of existing world, how this will change music, how this will change people's experience with music. He doesn't care at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly, downloading of music has, to some degree, lowered the value of songs and artists.
And as you point out, film is next.
Yes.
With Mega Upload, you could actually, you know, download files that
yeah,
big.
You know, that's real. Really the fear. I mean, that like the music industry compared to the film industry is like, I think it says like a co-op or something. It's like it's so minor, you know. Yeah. I mean, I'm not even really against downloading. I just know that it's changing the way people view songs. And as people who love music, of course, you care about that. And he seems to care less.
Mm. Yeah. Chuck Klosterman's book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. The idea that the villain is the person who knows the most and cares the least. You said there are some important exceptions. And finally, at the end of the book, you have to deal with Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you write about how you weren't going to deal with Hitler, and that was going to be your way of, and then people were saying, no, Hitler's in the book. It's got to be in the book.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Hitler is the kind of the best opposition to this idea the villain is the person who knows the most and cares the least. He's almost the complete opposite. I mean, he's somebody who did not know much and cared way too much about things that are very troubling. I was – at one point I was just sort of like, well, what is the benefit to writing about Hitler? I'm basically just, you know, absorbing information through the prism of other writers. It doesn't seem like I have much to add to this. It seems like a – almost like a problematic gamble. That there's just, you know, that the downside is greater than the upside. But whenever I would mention to people that I wasn't writing about Hitler, I would get these very strong reactions that this was a huge misstep and that I had to do this. So I sort of made the decision to do it. And of course, as soon as I did, everyone was like, you're crazy for doing this. You shouldn't write about Hitler. Sometimes the same people who told me I had to write about Hitler then said, like, don't, I think this is a real mistake, you know. So I sort of end up writing, as so often happens in this kind of case, writing about the problem of writing about Hitler and how it's not just a problem for me, but for lots of other artists.
And for you, as Chuck Klosterman, with a long history of writing about music, you end up writing about music about Hitler.
Mm.
And one song, and I mean, there's a couple of songs you mentioned, but the one I wanted to focus on is this Bob Dylan song with God on Our Side, which, I mean, how much do you have to read into this to get to Hitler, or how much is it pretty obvious what he's?
Well, I mean, the thing that's interesting about this song, many things are interesting about this song, but one is that when talking about the crucifixion of Jesus or you know, Judas or all of these things, Bob Dylan, as his wont, is sort of unclear almost what he's precisely saying. I
mean,
he is not a reliable narrator. He's the greatest non-reliable narrator in pop, probably. He's talking about something that, you know, we live in, you know, I think it's like 90% of America believes in angels or whatever. Like, this is a very religious world, right? And he's very comfortable being sort of unclear and hazy about what he's saying about this. But when he talks about World War II, he leaves no room for interpretation. It is the one time in the song when the lyrics are very straightforward and no one could hear those songs and misinterpret what his intention was. So even Bob Dylan, who's in like the most rarefied position of our culture, he is very uncomfortable saying anything about Hitler or Germany that a person could make a mistake on. Mm. You know, usually you think to yourself when you're, you know, an artist or a songwriter, it's like, well, I can't worry about people who get these words wrong. You know, I can't. You know, I can't. Be paralyzed by the idea that someone's going to misunderstand this. And yet, when dealing with Hitler, musicians still do that. Like, they know that this is not something that people can create their meaning for.
Yeah. Let's hear that that verse from the Bob Dylan song called With God on Our Side.
The Second World War came to an end. We forgave the Germans, and then we were friends. Though they murdered 6 million in the ovens they fried, the Germans now too have God on their side.
Bob Dylan, With God on Our Side, song that appears in Chuck Klosterman's new book called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. Chuck, it's a fun book to read. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me.
That Jesus Christ was betrayed by a kiss.
Tomorrow on the show, Tony Fletcher has joined us in the past to talk about his biographies, The Smiths, and the New York music scene. Well, now he's turned the lens on himself in a new book called Boy About Town, about growing up uncool but loving cool music at a major moment in the London music scene. That's tomorrow on Soundcheck. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop and Mike Katziff, with Isaac Davey Aronson, Krista Ripple, Amy Pearl, and our intern, Alex Martinez. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.